we are beginning a new sermon series today, and we'll be spending the next six or so weeks in the book of Esther. And just a few things about Esther. Esther is one of the wisdom books of the Bible. The easiest way to find it is to open up your Bible to the middle, which usually puts you in the book of Psalms, and then just page back to Job, and then one more, and that's Esther. Esther is a short book, 10 chapters, and it's the story upon which the Hebrew festival of Purim is based. And Purim means lots, as in dice, and it refers to the lots cast by Haman, or we call him Haman, and the king, to determine the date when the Jewish people would be killed, and that comes in chapter 3. As a wisdom book, Esther is probably has a lot in common with Ecclesiastes and with Job because of the kinds of questions that it raises. Questions that defy quick answers and require of us more faith than certainty as we engage the story. Esther opens with the same sort of once upon a time phrase as Ruth. Actually, this is a story that happened in the time of, and it sort of gives it that, sometime in the past, in a kingdom far, far away, that kind of a feel. There's not a real hard and fast, it happened, this day, this time, this place, which is what we tend to expect with our stories. But this is a Hebrew story with a delicious blend of mystery and irony and surprise and plenty of vagueness when it comes to some of those details. So before we get into the story, I think we need just a quick refresh of our history. Israel fell to Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon in 597 BCE, and then 586-87 is about when the temple was destroyed, and the people of Jerusalem were deported, taken to Babylon in several waves. And we know about their experience and that story because of the biblical record in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, Jeremiah and Ezra, and Daniel and Lamentations. So about 50 years go by, and it's 540 BCE, and Babylon is conquered by the latest and greatest superpower, which at that point is Persia. So by the time we get to Esther, we're in about 480 BCE, and the Jews have been living in Babylon / Persia in the diaspora for nearly a century. And Cyrus gave permission for all those exiles to return to Jerusalem in 540. But not everybody went. Over several generations, Esther's family, along with quite a few others, had made Persia their home. And that's actually something kind of unique about this story. Esther is really our only biblical glimpse into the experience of the Jews living in exile. That is, those who are living outside of Jerusalem and Israel. So as we enter into this first chapter of Esther today, I want to introduce two questions. First, what does the book of Esther teach us about God, about who God is? And second, what does the book of Esther teach us about ourselves? And of course, these are good questions for us to ask as we engage with any biblical text. You know, what does this story, what does this poem, what does this passage reveal to me about who God is? And then, of course, secondarily, what can I learn about myself and about my call and about my context as I read? Questions to keep asking ourselves over the coming weeks as we sit with this story of Esther. So I invite you now to hear these first 9 verses from the first chapter of Esther. This is God's word. This is the story of something that happened in the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces in all. King Xerxes ruled from his royal throne in the palace complex of Susa. In the 3rd year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his officials and ministers. The military brass of Persia and Media were also there, along with the princes and governors of the provinces. For 6 months, he put on exhibit the huge wealth of his empire and its stunningly beautiful royal splendors. At the conclusion of the exhibit, the king threw a week-long party for everyone living in Susa, the capital, important and unimportant alike. The party was in the garden courtyard of the king's summer house. The courtyard was elaborately decorated with white and blue cotton curtains tied with linen and purple cords to silver rings on marble columns. Silver and gold couches were arranged on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and colored stones. Drinks were served in gold chalices, each chalice one of a kind. The royal wine flowed freely, a generous king. The guests could drink as much as they liked, king's orders, with waiters at their elbows to refill the drinks. Meanwhile, Queen Vashti was throwing a separate party for women inside King Xerxes' royal palace. And to summarize the remainder of this first chapter, we're in the extravagantly wealthy court of King Xerxes, who has just spent 180 days with his male associates eating and drinking in excess while parading his wealth through his banquet hall for all to see and be impressed and be afraid. And after 6 months of that, plus one more week, it's no wonder that Xerxes is drunk on wine and on power. And he recalls one further possession that hasn't been paraded yet in front of his men, and that is his queen. And so he orders her to come and exhibit herself before this drunken crew, and to her great credit, she refuses. And this is an act of incredible bravery. This is a shame, honor culture, and for her to refute the authority of the king like that is really staggering, especially since as queen, it's really her job to uphold the social norms and to look good doing it. So Vashti's refusal to come when ordered, even though the order was illicit and inappropriate, nevertheless creates a cultural crisis. So Xerxes calls a quick cabinet meeting, and his advisors decide that Vashti is out. And chapter one ends with a message being sent to each one of Xerxes' 127 provinces, affirming exactly that which Xerxes himself couldn't quite manage. Every man is master of his own house. Whatever he says goes. That's the message. And so as we will see in the coming weeks, Xerxes will begin a search for a new queen. A sort of Miss Persia contest will get underway with next week's text. And as many as 1,000 women will be brought into the king's harem. And they will be given beauty treatments and training in order to get ready for their one night with the king. And so we'll meet Esther, who will ultimately be chosen by Xerxes to be queen. And of course, from there, she's in this unique position then to help save the Jewish people. Now, you may not have noticed it yet with just the first chapter, but there is a particularly odd omission in all 10 chapters of Esther. Not once is the Hebrew God mentioned. Not once. The book of Esther also contains no reference to prayer or prophecy or Torah. And it's unique in our biblical canon in that there's no religious mention of any kind. Unique, but not inadvertent, not an oversight. The author of Esther didn't just forget to include God. And in fact, there are several places where we see the author go out of his way to make sure he doesn't make any mention of religion. Later on, when Mordecai, Esther's uncle, learns of Haman's plot against the Jews, he tears his clothes and dresses in sackcloth and ashes. Sackcloth and ashes, of course, are a symbol of sorrow and grief, and they go hand in hand with prayer. You don't have one without the other. But not in this story. The author is careful to avoid any mention of prayer. So why? Why go to all this trouble to make sure you don't mention God? Well, this story is about a time when the Jewish people were in great danger. And what do we know about Israel's history when the God of Israel sees that his people are in trouble? What does this God typically do? Shows up. God shows up. God rescues his people when they are enslaved in Egypt. There's 10 plagues. The Red Sea parts. God leads his people with a pillar of fire by night. The people of Israel tend to get themselves into these horrific situations. And then when God comes through for them, it's very obvious. There's not a shadow of a doubt that God is at work. No question who parted the sea or sent the angel or made the bush burn. Well, here in this story, the Jewish people are again going to be in dire straits. So where is God? Where are the big signs? Where are the dramatic miracles? There aren't any. There's no visions, no burning bushes, nothing parts, no mention of God at all. God is silent. And yet, the whole story of Esther turns on these frequent coincidences, which, even if just one of them had not happened at the right time, the Jews would have been wiped out. If Xerxes had not banished Vashti when she refused to appear, Esther would never have been made queen. If Mordecai hadn't overheard a plot to kill the king, then he wouldn't have been honored at just the right time. If the king had been able to sleep instead of having the annals of history read to him. We'll see as we go through this story one coincidence after the next with precision timing. Ordinary things that don't seem particularly germane or significant at the time, but in retrospect, were absolutely essential in order for the Jews to be saved. It's a different way of looking at God's involvement in the lives of his people. That is to say, when God parts the Red Sea, we can all point to it and say, that's God. God did that. When Gideon's 300 men defeat the army of thousands from Midian, we can point to that and say, that is God at work. When Jesus feeds 20,000 men, women, and children with two fish and five loaves? With not much, we can say, God showed up. This is a miracle. God's been here. When Billy Graham had a crusade and thousands came to faith, we all pointed to that and said, God is here. When Xerxes gets drunk and makes inappropriate demands of his wife, who among us would say, wow, there is God at work? No. When Haman plots to kill an entire people because of one man's offense, is there someone saying, wow, there's God at work again? No, we think we know what it looks like when God is at work, right? And don't we all have seasons of our lives in which we've turned to God and asked for help, pleaded for his involvement, asked for a rescue mission, for healing, for a simple answer to our prayers? And hasn't it felt like to us the silence of God, as if God doesn't care? Like there's this glass ceiling over us and our prayers just bounce right back? and life goes on without one iota of the kind of divine reply that we would expect or hope for from a God who's involved and invested in our lives. There's a saying from my graduate days in creative writing, one that we used to get tired of hearing the professor say. As someone would be reading their work, he would stop and say, "Show it, don't tell it." In other words, don't tell the reader what happens and all that it means with your lengthy expository paragraphs. Show the reader what it means with your characters and your dialogue and your action. The author of Esther is a master of show, don't tell. He doesn't explain how God is at work in every coincidence, every circumstance that leads to the redemption of God's people. He shows us how God uses it all, from the most reprehensibly selfish decision of the cruelest villain to the most courageous act of bravery of our heroine, all of it to save the Jewish people, to accomplish God's purposes, and to fulfill God's promises. With the story of Esther, the author is warning us from behind the scenes, don't be such a fool as to interpret God's silence in this story as God's absence. God made a promise to Abraham that through his family, God was going to heal the world. Across generations and generations, through war and peace, amidst famine and plenty, in Jerusalem and around the world, in ordinary and unexpected ways, God is fulfilling that promise. So as we begin our time with Esther, what is revealed to us about God? When God works in extraordinary ways, we know it. We can see it. But when God works in ordinary ways, when we can't see it, our typical reaction is to conclude that God's not there. When you and I can't hear or see or make sense of God's work in our midst, we are tempted to conclude that God is absent. Esther tells us a different story. Esther gives us hope. Our God is never absent. God's silence is not God's absence. His hiddenness is not abandonment. He is working out your salvation and mine, and he's keeping his promises, even when it looks like he's nowhere to be found. Okay, second question. What does the book of Esther teach us about ourselves? When I was a kid, we had a book of illustrated Bible stories, and my favorite picture was the one of Queen Esther. I can still see the illustration, her and her crown and her dress, and the title was Brave Esther. And I've always loved the story, and I've loved Brave Esther, who stood up to the king at the risk of her own life to save her people. So I was a bit surprised, taken aback, to read quite a few of negative reviews of Esther. It seems that everyone loves brave Vashti because she stands up for herself. But Esther? Not so much. Esther gets to the throne through compliance and submission. She follows the commands of her uncle. She takes specific directions from the eunuch. Pastor and theologian Tim Keller calls Esther the Barbie doll and the sex kitten of the 4th century BCE. And he's in good company of that opinion. By being exactly who who those in power expect her to be, Esther achieves the top spot. And it would seem, although there's plenty of differing opinions about this story, Esther doesn't live up to anyone's expectations, certainly not in the first few chapters. When we read the story of Daniel and his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, four Jewish captives who are, like Esther, introduced into a pagan court, these young men make an announcement right up front saying, "We will serve you, yes, but we will do so as faithful Jews. We will follow Torah and its dictates about our prayer lives and our diet and our relationships at the cost of our lives." Esther does not disclose her Jewish heritage to the eunuchs or the harem. Quite the opposite. Esther works to blend in. She avoids calling attention to herself, and she goes with the flow, which means that when she's brought her meals, along with the other women in the harem, she eats what they eat. And when Jewish law would tell her to interrupt her day in order to spend time in prayer, she's keeping the schedule of the other women in the harem with their beauty treatments and their training and their socializing. And when she's called to spend her one night with the king, she sleeps with a man to whom she is not married. And when she does marry, she weds a non-Jew. All of these things are explicit breaches of God's law, forbidden in the Torah. And no matter how much we might like to give Esther room for circumstances beyond her control, still, she does not shine as a follower of Yahweh. She got lost, writes one commentator. She sold out, writes another. Esther and her people were living in Persia as a religious minority, surrounded by a society, a culture, with spiritual and moral values at great variance with their own. Does that sound at all familiar to you or to me? We are a people whose prayer is supposed to be for God's kingdom to be enacted not just up in heaven, but here on earth. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. We are meant and called to live by the rules of that kingdom. Love your neighbor. Our treasure is in heaven. Serve one another in love. But the dominant culture all around us is at war with every part of this. It's a me-first culture. My kids in line in front of your kids. My kingdom, not yours. The bully takes the day. And as a culture, we are riddled with anxiety and a desperate need to make success happen in this life, in this world, in this moment. And you and I may have flashes of truth and insight as to how to live in this culture, but I think often what Paul wrote speaks for us. What I want to do, I don't do. What I don't want to do, I do. So you and I understand the pressure that Esther would have felt to sell out to the cultural system around her because it felt like her only option. To ignore the practices of her faith because, by gosh, it took everything she had to keep up appearances in the world in which she existed. And so this is where the good news comes in, for Esther and for us. Esther did not get off to a good start. She got into a trajectory that kept her lying and covering and selling herself out as things progressed. And as we go on, we will see her fear and her unwillingness to break with the compliant and acceptable path that she is on. But God, people in her, who haven't asked for his grace or his love or his coaching or his severe mercies, who don't deserve such gifts, and who often don't appreciate them after they've received them. With our God, it's both grace and growth. Yes, we receive grace, and then we respond, and we go forward with God at our side. Dan Baumgartner is the pastor of Hollywood Presbyterian Church, and on Easter Sunday, he told a story about a woman who was sharing her story, her experience, publicly and for the first time at a large meeting in a recovery program. The meeting was full of people who had lived, whose journeys were marked by addiction, and as such, had seen the very hardest parts of life. And as this woman shared her story, the men and the women who were present, who were not only used to stories of great pain and loss and brokenness, but had themselves lived out those kind of stories, were nevertheless utterly riveted. The woman talked about her life not just as a meth addict, but actually running a meth lab. She talked about the desperation of each day, about falling into prostitution, about losing each one of her children. The room got quieter and quieter as she continued to share, speaking about a darkness so prolonged and so profound and so nightmarish that as she finally stumbled to an end, the silence in the room had grown to a sense of utter shock. And no one moved. And still the silence grew, as no one seemed to be able to find the words to speak into her brokenness. Even these people who had lived in darkness themselves seemed unable to bridge the gap between her story and their own. Finally, mercifully, from the back of the room came a grizzled old voice, loud enough to speak into that vacuous space, as he called out, "The word of the Lord." And another voice, equally gruff, responded, "Thanks be to God for his word." Yes, there was silence. Yes, there was a devastating darkness and horrific trials of pain and loneliness. And yes, God was present in it. God was holding her story as God was holding her. God was walking through that darkness, however silent he might have appeared to her. And God was walking with her in recovery and into her relapses, and into every messy and frightening and difficult step she would take toward healing. There is never a point at which God has given up on us. This is what the book of Esther teaches us and reminds us about who this God is. It's not a demanding parent who demands perfection. Not a toothless old grandpa who just wants us to avoid pain and be happy. What do we learn about God in Esther's story? That God is at work in ordinary and extraordinary circumstances and relationships and details in our lives, in every minute of every day. And there's always a bigger story of which we are a part. And what do we learn about ourselves from Esther's story? We belong to God, not to this world, but to the living God. And no matter how far we walk from him, it's never too far. God doesn't waste a single bit of our experience in the darkness. And he uses it to draw us back to the light. God doesn't leave us to the Persians or to the plateau. God persists. The word of the Lord. Say it with me. Thanks be to God for his word. Amen.